weather is what's happening. This is what we talk about on the show. This is Weather Brains episode number 376. This is for April 8th, 2013. The spring days, warmer weather, severe weather, pollen. It's all happening right now. It's a great time of the year, and we're glad you're with us. And we've got a huge cast on the program this evening, including Brian Peters, the internationally beloved meteorologist. Brian, where have you been this week?
I've been trying to sweep all the yellow pollen off my porch.
It's a losing battle. It's nasty where we are.
It is. I mean, my dog walks across the porch and she leaves a trail. Not only that, then we got all this pollen that comes into her fur and that comes into the house. And it's a mess. I love spring, but sometimes I hate spring.
So I want to, is anybody on this show an expert in why the pollen is so bad this year? It's not really a weather question. Nobody is raising their hand.
Well, some of it, there are two things. Number one, it just came on suddenly because we've had such a cool, wet winter, and that's allowed the trees to sort of say, there have been a little bit of freezing temperatures, but for the most part, it's been just above freezing, and so things have been growing. But you combine that with a wet stretch we had late last week and then starting to get warm and dry and a little breezy, and all of a sudden that pollen has nowhere to go but in your nose.
I thought it was just because the daggum trees were blooming.
Well, that too. They've been waiting for long enough. And now they're all blooming at once.
They all waited to do it at the same time.
Yeah,
it's amazing. But I mean, if you look at the countryside where we are down here in the southern United States, it looks like, a hazy July day. The truth is the visibility is excellent. There's no haze. It's all pollen. So it's nasty. So
yeah, it was funny, that picture of Aniston today with that, just a cloud of pollen.
It's really pretty bad. So, Brian, you had a little assignment. You want to share that assignment with us? What'd you do this weekend for fun?
I had a wonderful weekend. It was great. I was the weather support to the Honda Indy Grand Prix at Barber Motorsports in Birmingham, Alabama.
Wow.
And the weather for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the weather was absolutely superb.
And they paid him $3,000 per day to sit out there and say it's not going to rain. So that's the kind of job.
I need to figure out how to get that job. Good grief.
Don't worry.
Kind of work.
They'll probably hire me next year, and I'll work my tail off with thunderstorms and tornadoes.
And, best of all, that they gave Brian a nice place in the infield with a Bluebird bus and gave him a wife beater shirt to wear during the race.
An Indy race, man, not a NASCAR race.
I don't know what he's been drinking or smoking, but I tell you one thing. I don't remember any Bluebird buses.
but he does remember the wife beater shirt. I mean, he looks really good in that.
It really was nice because I get to sit in the air-conditioned third floor of the race control building.
Ooh.
So I have a great shot, a great view of the pits and the checkered flag spot. So it was fun watching.
So watch this. Let's see if Brian knows who won the Grand Prix. Do you have any idea?
The guy who came in first.
All right. I saw Brian out there, and that was a lot of fun. We've got our resident crank, Kevin Selly, who's in Dallas.
Thank you. Where's this racetrack? There's a racetrack in downtown now?
We got the Talladega Super Speedway, which is a little east of the city. This is an IndyCar track that has been built in one of the suburbs of Birmingham. That's between the city of Birmingham and Talladega. So it's racing heaven out here.
It's more than just Indy, though, because it's sports cars, it's motorcycles, it's Indy.
How long has that been there?
Oh, gosh.
6 or 7 years, probably.
Yeah, I was going to say about 7, I think.
Of course, I've been gone for 20, so they had plenty of time to finish it.
Absolutely.
So, Dallas-Fort Worth, you got some severe weather coming up this week. You ready to go? You excited? You pumped?
I'm kind of interested in this. Yeah, it's going to be a nighttime deal for us, but it's a pretty good jet coming around the base of that thing. And boy, it's humid over here. We're not suffering in the pollen, though. You had a great picture on the Google Plus. There was some long distance, and there's just this cloud of yellow in front of a mountain range out there. That was amazing.
Yeah, it's downright creepy. So what kind of you're going to have tornado action, storms? What do you expect out there?
looking for a line of storms. I think it's going to probably start late after midnight, move real slow until the upper low catches up and the trough catches up. So we'll just
this is Tuesday night, May the 9th, we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, Tuesday night into Wednesday morning. We get a lot of these deals when the trough, you got to wait for the trough to come through. We get this line and we sit here and you get after midnight and then it finally starts to catch up to the I-35 corridor and we just sit and twiddle our thumbs and do things like Weather Brains.
That's true. You ought to be good at that. You get a lot of practice on this show. Yes. Nate Johnson is in Raleigh, North Carolina with the booming microphone and preamp.
Yes. How are y'all?
You sound so rich and so full and you're so much of a manly man. Yes.
Manly man. Yes. Well, you know. You do with what you have, with what God gave you, and then you run it and process the hell out of it till it sounds good. Wish I could do that to my hair, but you know.
I feel your pain, brother.
That's a good idea. We need a preamp for hair. We need to work on that.
That might be the show title.
I like that idea.
Things going well here. We've got probably Thursday night, and it's when we might see some of that weather around these parts. Until then, it's dry and pleasantly comfortably warm, and we're starting to deal with a little bit of pollen here as well. Pollen jumped this morning, and I expect it to continue to jump every day this week.
Yep, it's that time of the year. And
James, there's some news going by. Did you see this?
News going by?
There's I'm seeing some news going by. You better play the audio. Now, I hesitate to ask this because you fouled it up so badly last week.
Well, I've got the button ready right now.
This program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
I'm David Black, and this is just in to WeatherBrains International Headquarters. We are now confirming that the Weather Channel will, in fact, be naming spring storm systems. The first storm of the season will be named...
Kapuya! Kapuya!
More information is coming in from our chief investigative correspondent, Matthew Selle. Matthew, what are you hearing?
David, in addition to Kapuya, we've learned that additional storms this spring will be named Woohoo, Yippee, Coochie Coochie Coo, and Who's Got Your Nose? David?
This has been a special report from WeatherBrains Worldwide Headquarters.
There you go.
I can hardly wait for Coochie Coochie Coo.
Breaking news.
Only on this show do you get that kind of information. Nowhere else but right here, thanks to our I-team that's on it. So that was awesome. All right. We better let Bill Murray take over and bring our guest in before he really hangs up on us after that. And by the way, for those people that are not able to watch, I'm telling you, when our guest popped up on the screen, I thought I was seeing two Brian Peters. I mean, this is great. They both got the beard thing going, and this is great. So, Bill, you take it over.
Yeah, now Hal's calling me for some reason, Lee. I'm not quite sure what that means. Lee, you are there, right?
I think he's frozen and gone.
Yeah, I do too.
He was apparently insulted by our breaking news.
Yourselves for a minute.
Talk amongst yourselves. I'll give you a topic. Weather Holy Brains shit. Is neither weather nor brains discuss.
Very nice.
So Kevin, why don't we talk about to take the show off the rails before we even get started down the track. So the email that you forwarded to me and James.
Isn't that something? Yeah. Yes.
So you're forwarding email to just part of the group?
Well, let him explain. Yeah. This is good. Let him explain it.
Okay. It was a TV thing. I didn't know if you'd be interested or not, but it may be just saber rattling, but the Fox Network, you have to know a little bit of background. You have to be paying attention to tech, to this thing called Aereo. It's a new service that's in New York, and it is television, local television channels, over the internet. And the way they do it, because in theory you cannot transmit local television channels over anything except over the air without getting a license from the broadcasting companies and so on and so forth. So this company Aereo has gotten around that, because what they do is for every subscriber in their system in New York City, they get a tiny little antenna. It's about the size of a dime. And then they put one for each account. And then, so the way they're doing is they're saying, we're not transmitting this over a cable or over the internet. We're actually just receiving it via this little antenna and then allowing the users via the internet to watch that programming. Well, the broadcasters get money from retransmission agreements, and the cable companies obviously get money by having local television channels on. But this Aereo is thwarting that system, and it's gone to court, and so far Aereo has been winning. In fact, they have a plan to roll out, and I think it's in 22 other cities.
Yeah, Houston, Chicago.
Yeah, Dallas is one of them. It's only $8 a month. Oh, that's great. $8 a month to get local television channels, but the broadcasters are having a fit. And so the president of Fox...
DVR service and everything else.
DVR service.
And it's worth putting into context that all this conversation has come as a result of meetings at the National Association of Broadcasters Conference that's going on right now in Las Vegas.
Right.
And so, and one of the big foci of this is one of the things that's getting a lot of press is how to deal with these zero TV people. That is people who have either cut cable and satellite or who have never had it. And Aero is one of these groups that are one of these companies that looks to try and provide low cost, television to people that don't want to have antennas or can't get reception or what have you. So Kevin, chime in because this is interesting.
Well, this Aereo thing has gotten enough traction to where the broadcasters are really scared. But now I guess at NAB, Fox is rattling its saber, and the president of the network has said that they're going to threaten to pull all of the Fox programming from the local broadcast stations and take it over to cable, meaning you'd have to have some sort of cable service in order to see the Fox primetime programming, for example, in the evenings. And that's a pretty big deal if they were to do it. And then you ask yourself, well, would the other broadcasters follow suit? Because they feel like Aereo is taking money from them, that they're not being paid for the signals that they have, which, quite frankly, they're given by us, the people, and the government through their licenses. So I'm not quite sure that argument makes a lot of sense, but it's a pretty big deal in the business. It's not a weather thing. But
let me ask you this now. Don't these local stations have a contract with Fox where Fox has there's a deal where Fox just can't break a contract, can they?
Yeah, and what happened is that as each one of those affiliation agreements comes up, the network would, in theory, just cut ties with that station and put their programming on a cable network. And my first reaction to this is, well, ain't that the, cutting off the nose to spite the face kind of thing? Because if you look, unless you're ESPN, look at ratings for basic cable. There's a reason that broadcast television is as good as it is. One of those reasons is that it is widely available. In a lot of cases, cable companies have to carry those local stations. For example, just to point out, I'm a Cubs fan, and the local cable company here doesn't carry WGN in HD. They carry them in SD, but they don't carry them in HD. Well, in local stations are covered by what's called a must-carry provision. So if you're one of the local affiliates, the cable company has to offer you on the lowest tier of service. And that increases, so places that wouldn't be able to get a signal, places a little farther away from the transmitter tower, they're going to get those stations where they might not otherwise get them. And if Fox decides they bail and jump over to cable, I don't think their ratings are going to be as good. They'd probably still be better than your normal basic cable, but their ratings would take a hit because fewer people would have access to the signal, period.
Well, this is a tactic that local stations have been doing for a number of years now that they do with the cable systems. And if you're in a market that's been affected, you know about this or you've heard it, because when the retransmission agreement, and that's the permission to rebroadcast the signal, comes up, they kind of go through these gyrations where the cable company wants money and the broadcaster wants money and so on and so forth. And then the agreement comes up. And so the broadcaster pulls the signal for a couple of days and everybody misses their Dancing with the Stars or whatever program they watch for a couple of days, and they hoot and holler, and each entity blames the other one for not dealing fairly. And so within a couple of days, or usually not more than a week or so, the signal comes back on. And I think this is probably going to be an example of that again, because the large broadcasters, quite frankly, they can't yet afford to cut off the local stations, largely because they own so many of them. And again, it's saber rattling because you make these threats and maybe you inconvenience people for a couple of days. But the fact is, local television stations still make a lot of money. And until they figure out a way to supplement or replace that lost income. If, for example, they lost a local broadcast affiliate, they're not going to be able to do it for any length of time. They just can't afford it.
My position is good riddance. If ABC came in here tonight and said, we're not going to, you know, allow our station in Birmingham, Alabama to carry our programming, good riddance. You know, they got like maybe one or two shows that people watch, like Dancing with the Stars. Most of it's junk. I mean, I look at some of these primetime ratings, and we get like a one or a two leading into the newscast, and it bumps up, you know, to an eight or a nine. We got to take that, you know, bad lead in. It's awful. It's just junk. So good riddance. Go on. Bye.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I think this is a step up from, you know, pulling a signal in a local market or one or two markets like they've done in the past. This is talking about doing it across the whole country. But they, I mean, you know, these guys aren't stupid, the networks and the cable companies. They know, you know, where the money's coming from. They're just trying to figure out how to avoid too much pain during the transition. And, you know, they would feel it in this because I think one of the articles I read said that maybe 90% of the country is now wired either via cable or UVerse like we have at my house or Fios or Time Warner, whatever it is. That leaves 10% of the homes that have televisions watching over the air or maybe watching over internet. But, you know, a 10% loss, that's something. But quite frankly, I have nothing to prove this, but I really think that the networks and the large broadcasters, at the end of the day for the networks, they really only care about the top 10 or 20 markets. When you start talking about, you know, I don't know, Boise, Idaho, wherever it is, and I'm sure Boise's a lovely place, but it, you know, in aggregate, all of those little markets do make some difference. But when you're talking about the top markets, you're talking about tens and tens of millions of people. And that's all they really care about.
You're very typically top 25 is the cutoff. That's where a lot of the national ad agencies will try to do large buys, especially car dealerships and stuff. I mean, local and statewide car dealerships are one thing, but at a national level, the national folks typically look at those top 25 markets or so. And that's one of those 80-20 sorts of things that you get 80% of the return on 20% of the investment in those top 25 markets. And it may be top 20, top 40, top 30, depending on, you know, the particular agency and what they're after. But, you know, Kevin, you're right on that. And you get a lot of these smaller stations in the middle of the country, especially. And, you know, the network could care less.
Well, we should spin this back to weather a little bit and talk about the local affiliates, because this is just going to be another chunk out of the local affiliates that have, you know, depend in many cases on lead-in programming and both morning and at night.
And an interesting example of this, Kevin, is Cron in San Francisco. You remember about 10 years ago, they NBC went. Right. They were one of the first stations that where it used to be. The old model was that television stations got paid by the network to carry their programming.
Right.
Network compensation.
Yes. And I remember, you know, sitting in a meeting with the comptroller of the company that owned the station I had my first job at. And he was explaining this to us. And he said that there will come a day very soon when stations will be paying networks to carry their programming. And we all thought he was nuts, but he was prophetic. And that's exactly what happened. NBC went to Cron and said, you know, we want you to pay us. We're not going to pay you. And there were some other things going on. Eventually, Cron lost the NBC affiliateship because another station in the market said, hey, NBC, we'll pony up. We're game. Let's do this. And so Cron lost their affiliation. And their ratings had some issues. Now, I don't know the exact details, but that's the kind of thing that, you know, the network programming, even as bad as NBC is, still draws eyeballs.
Well, but we can continue this.
We got to stop because the guest is back. But let me ask you guys real quick. I think this whole thing's going, once all these contracts wind down, I mean, why does ABC need us? And the next question is, why does Hollywood need ABC? And why does the NCAA need ESPN? They can just stream their content straight to Joe Q Public when everybody's got this big pipe.
And this is exactly what Terry Heaton has been talking about for how long, Kevin? the separation of the channel from the content provider.
Yeah,
and if I can bypass the content provider, which in this case are the cable companies, the individual television stations, and in some cases the networks, and get my programming straight from the studios, why wouldn't I? And right, Warner Brothers just last week opened up their archive for something like $8 a month for every Warner Brothers production older than a year or something like that. That's crazy. Yeah.
There's too much money involved, and I think one of the things, you know, they have to find a way to replace what's being lost. I kind of wonder if you took it, this would actually be interesting to see if they won't do it this way, but if Fox said, okay, we're leaving the net the broadcast stations and we're going all internet. Because of the 50 years of the rating system that we have had, which is largely built on vapor, I think there's a big fear when you've got actual downloads to deal with and to talk about, actual numbers of people who watched rather than some sort of educated guess based upon a few diaries and a few meters in each market, that they're afraid that the numbers might be a lot lower. And that's going to have a backlash with regard to the advertisers. If Nielsen says 5 million people are watching Modern Family, and then you take it off the air and it's only via download and only 1 million people watch, well, guess who's not going to be very pleased with that? That's going to be the advertisers. They'll still advertise, but they're not going to pay as much money for it. The problem with the local television stations that we've been doing for a number of years, and Facebook and Twitter is part of this, is that we're just letting other things chip away at our base without building anything significant on our own. And proof of that, this past week, we can talk about this later, but the Weather Channel now has a relationship with Twitter, and that's going to be a pretty important thing.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, I'll tell you what, we got our guest back, so we'll pick this conversation up later. But Bill Murray, I'll let you introduce our guest who hung up on us, and you had to talk him into coming back on the show after 20 minutes.
Yeah, we had to beg and plead and promise a lot of money, James. So make sure all those Audible commercials are coming in over there. But Dr. Ken Hoagland suggested tonight's guest, Weather Brain, and he wrote this in his message. He said, I do listen to other podcasts. That's hard to believe. And one of his regulars is Living on Earth, an environmental podcast. And the week that he listened, they had tonight's guest, Weather Brain, on the show, who had written a new book called Storm Kings, which traces early storm chasers. He was very articulate and interesting, which we can't understand why he came on this show, but I'll tell him to make an outstanding guest for Weather Brains. So that's my suggestion. The book, Lee, for a session to benefit us weather geeks. So there's no pressure here tonight, Lee. You're an award-winning journalist, essayist, born in Wildwood, Illinois, grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, attended the University of Chicago and Roosevelt University before leaving school to travel and write. And I just finished his wonderful book, Storm Kings. And tonight we welcome Lee Sandlin to the show. Lee, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, Lee, you opened the book with a very interesting story from your childhood, and I can relate to it because my family loved to tell these terrifying stories about tornadoes because I was born in the early 60s. And it seems like in Alabama in the late 50s, we had just a spate of, you know, terrible storms, including a horrible, you know, what probably was an F5 tornado that moved through western Jefferson County and killed a lot of people. So these stories weighed heavily on my mind. It sounds like your father and my dad must have known each other.
It does sound similar. Yeah, my father's from Oklahoma, and he was always telling me stories of tornadoes. I grew up mostly in Illinois. And so I was always aware of the Midwest as the home of tornadoes. And I grew up, you know, my father always loved to scare me with stuff like that. So I grew up quite scared of them. And the starting point of the book in some ways was the nightmares I used to have about them when I was a kid.
So having been frightened by them as a child, how many of them have you experienced in your life?
I was in one small one when I was 17, and I've seen several from a distance. The small one I was in was pretty scary. It didn't actually cause much damage. Knocked down some trees and stove in a couple of roofs. The thing that was frightening to me was that I was just about to step outside my house. I had my hand on the doorknob when the tornado passed over us. And I just was looking out through the door, and I saw every single thing on the street that wasn't nailed down sweep straight up into the air, and the sky grew pitch black. And then it was over in just a few seconds. So, but that was a pretty memorable moment.
So were these experiences enough to be the impetus for the book, or was there something else that planted the seed that germinated into Storm Kings?
Well, you know, the specific thing that happened was that I was having a conversation with a couple of friends of mine a few years ago, and I don't know if you remember that big volcano in Iceland that knocked out the air travel in Europe. And my friends had just been about to go to Europe, and one of them said, as she grew up in northern Canada, and she said, you know, when I was a kid, this is exactly the sort of thing I used to have anxiety dreams about. And one of the other people there said, well, I'm from Illinois. I would never dream about volcanoes. All my dreams are about tornadoes. And I thought, well, so are mine. And I started thinking, I think that's a very common Midwestern thing to have this terror. So that was really the starting point, trying to figure out, you know, how tornadoes are sort of rooted in the heartland mentality.
Now, one of your first stories is about a person, a man named Samuel Stone. Tell us who he was and how he figured into the story.
He was the earliest person I could find in America who actually went through a tornado. He and his son were out working in the fields, and they saw what they described as a cloud passing overhead that was singing. And they saw a funnel cloud form in the fields nearby. And the tornado formed and swept right past them. And they had absolutely no idea what it was. And as far as I can figure out, nobody in America, or really in the world, had any much idea that tornadoes even existed up until that point. But that was the earliest trace of one I was able to find in America. And the book follows through several more from the late 17th century and early 19th century, or early 18th century.
To an interesting source to try to explain this. He went to Increase Mather, right? Who was a preacher.
Yeah, he was Cotton Mather's father. He was one of the best educated men in America. He was a real hellfire and brimstone preacher, but he was also spellbound by weather stories. He collected all kinds of odd and unusual weather stories. And he did a book where he just listed all of the stories he'd collected over the years, including this storm and a couple of others that possibly might have been tornadoes.
I've always heard about Espy and Redfield and the little tiff they had. Why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Well, they were the two first serious authorities on tornadoes in the early 19th century, and they had two violently opposing theories as to what tornadoes were, and had a feud that lasted for 20 years that managed to essentially paralyze American science for a generation, because everybody had to choose up sides between the two, and neither one could see any merit in the other's point of view. Espy believed tornadoes were a rising column of air, which is, of course, correct, and Redfield believed that tornadoes rotated, which is also correct, but neither would accept that the other side was right.
Now, somewhere in the middle here, Ben Franklin gets insinuated into the story we don't realize he may have been the first storm chaser in America. Is that right?
Yeah, he was the first person I was able to find who actually chased a tornado. He did it on horseback. It was a small tornado. He claimed that he was riding alongside it and lashing it with his riding crop to see if he could get it to break up.
That's the same thing they do today. They just do that also. Exactly. Just faster cars.
Yeah, exactly. The impulse is exactly the same. Everybody else in the group that he was riding with was scared to death, and he just could not resist riding after this thing.
So Reed Timmer's great 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 grandfather may have been Ben Franklin, huh? Somewhere spiritual, along the way.
Spiritual ancestor, anyway. Yeah.
Lee, where do you find the Ben Franklin stuff? Where is you go and research that? But is it sitting in a box of papers somewhere? How do you find that stuff?
Well, Franklin's life is pretty well documented, and even early on, he was so celebrated that they were publishing collected volumes of his writings as early as the early 19th century. The thing is that his scientific papers are usually the volumes nobody ever looked at. But if you look at those, you can find enormous numbers of letters that he wrote describing tornadoes or in his interest in water spouts and all kinds of weird weather phenomena. He was kind of a flighty guy in a certain way. He went from interest to interest really quickly. And he spent a couple of years spellbound by the idea of tornadoes and then kind of ran into a bunch of people who, his friends, who didn't really believe the tornadoes existed or didn't buy his theories about it. And he sort of lost interest and moved on.
So along comes a man named John Park Finley, who we've heard a lot about.
Yeah.
Explain how politics sort of squelched him too, Lee.
Well, that was a part of the meteorological history in America that maybe not such a good thing. In the late 19th century, the National Weather Service was a division of the U.S. military. It was run by the Signal Corps. And Finley was a Signal Corps officer who was traveling around the country doing tornado reports. And he was trying to work out ways of predicting them. And one of the things that they were discovering doing these reports is the tornadoes were much more common in the Midwest than anybody had previously believed. But there were a lot of people then who didn't like that news, particularly people who were selling real estate. And they essentially pressured the National Weather Service into backing away from tornado prediction. So Finley's work got lost in that political, these political disputes. There were a lot of people in the Weather Service who would start saying things like, Iowa has only one tornado a year. This same person who was actually in charge of the National Weather Service office in Iowa said that people shouldn't build storm cellars, which is the few practical things you can do about tornadoes, because you were much more in danger of dying of damp than you were of being killed by a tornado.
and so along comes Adolphus Greeley. And talk about how he fit into the mix.
You're going to have to remind me, where did I talk about him?
Well, he sort of became in charge of the Weather Bureau and sort of Finley's research.
Yeah, Greeley was kind of a bizarre guy, actually. He took over the Weather Service I'm blanking on all these names. The book a year ago. Hazen, exactly. General Hazen, when he died, Greeley was one of his proteges. And he took over the service. He wasn't really suited for the job. And he also had this scandal in his past. Hazen had sent him on an Arctic expedition early in the Signal Corps' weather work. And the expedition was a disaster. Most of the people on the expedition died. Greeley and those who survived were widely suspected of having practiced cannibalism to stay alive. And while he was cleared of any wrongdoing, he believed from then on, as you can understand why, that anybody who met him, all they were really thinking about is, well, were you really a cannibal? And it kept him from advancing as far as he thought he should. And he sort of presided over the dissolution of the Signal Corps Weather Service because it was being transferred to civilian control then. And all of the old meteorological workers were getting broken up and scattered back into the service.
Well, the prevailing theme seemed to be Weather Bureau ineptitude, and that came to a head with the Louisville tornado in 1890. As you write about in the book.
Yeah.
But it would still be many, many years. In 1925, the tri-state tornado goes by with plenty of potential warning and nothing happens.
Yeah.
And then you sort of fast forward today. And, you know, you took a very brief look at the Joplin tornado.
Yes.
Talk about that for a minute.
Well, you know, I've heard of a bunch of mixed. This is the problem with writing journalism, is you get one half of the story and then later somebody says, no, you got it entirely wrong. The way that I heard from people about the Joplin tornado was that the system worked perfectly and it still didn't make any difference. That they had 20 minutes of warning, that the sirens had all gone off, that people were should have been perfectly prepared, and they weren't. And of course, you know, 150 people were killed. Now, I've since heard from other people saying, no, that's all wrong. There were no warnings. You know, nobody heard anything. And the Weather Service might have known about it, but the people didn't know, which would be even worse, really. So I'm not certain at this point what the truth of it is, but it's hard to avoid the feeling, however it came out, that we're not really making the advances on tornado prediction and even managing the existence of tornadoes that we might think. We might get to the point of saying, we're doing okay, we've basically got a handle on all the big problems. And it really kind of looks, from things like the Joplin tornado, like we're nowhere near as far along as we think we are.
I think that one of the interesting things about that, though, is a comment you made that the system worked perfectly. And I would argue that it didn't work perfectly, but I'm using a different standard.
Sure.
You know, I think, you know, the folks that say the system worked perfectly, and I think, you know, some of the folks in Joplin, emergency managers, that sort of thing, said the system worked exactly like they had said it should,
right,
in terms of how they sounded the sirens, the number of times, that sort of thing.
But
the research that's been done in Joplin since then proves, or shows, I don't know that proves, but it shows that the people there didn't interpret the siren communication the way that it was intended by the people sounding it, with the multiple soundings, the fact that you had polygons that were overlapping in a very odd way, and then some issues about the wording inside some of the tornado warnings about where the tornado was going to go or not,
sure,
go, as the case may be. And I think that's the challenge, is that, you know, we have, we invest ourselves in these systems that we build up, and we think that they're going to be great and wonderful. And this almost ties back into the conversation we were having while we were getting you back online, is that we build all of these systems, and then we're invested not in the result that the system is intended to produce, but we're invested in the system itself. So instead of being, you know, television exists to communicate with people, we're invested not in communicating with people, but in using the existing technology to milk people out of money, which is a different thing. The sirens are, you know, there not to, you know, for emergency, and I'm not picking on Joplin specifically, but the sirens are not there for people to, you know, to sound. They're there to warn people, but people aren't interpreting them that way. In your research, did you find anything that aligned up with that? I mean, is there a mismatch between the expectation of what the system is supposed to do,
sure,
and what people expect it to do?
Well, I'll tell you, a couple of years ago, there were tornado sirens in Chicago. There was a report from a Doppler radar of circulation in a superstill storm that was passing over the city. They sounded the tornado sirens. My wife happened to be standing on an elevated platform, heard the sirens, and she said to everybody, we got to take shelter. And no one else on the platform had any idea what the sirens meant.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, you've got exactly proof of what you're saying. They have the system. They have advance warnings. They're up to around 20 minutes advance warning on a lot of these tornadoes, and no one has any idea what they're supposed to do. In a lot of the country, there isn't anything you could do anyway. And part of the problem in Joplin is there's nowhere to take shelter, even if you wanted to take shelter. Most of the new construction in the Midwest, there aren't basements, there aren't interior closets, there aren't the most elementary precautions taken for storm shelter.
It's interesting because some of the research that's been done in terms of, you know, the storm survey service assessments the Weather Service does, and some of the research that's been done where researchers go in and interview people, much in the same way that the journalists might, but, you know, doing it sort of with a research bent to it. And what we found, the thing that I am reviewing all this, the thing that I found is that on the one hand, sirens are critically important. People, they rank right up there with television in the number one or number two slot in how people get the warning. But there's also a lot of confusion about what they mean. And what we found out is that, and I say we, the community has found out that, you know, people aren't, they don't hear the siren and go straight for the basement.
Right.
They hear the siren and then they have to, you know, to figure out what that means and whether that means go inside or whatnot. And then you factor in the false alarms and that becomes a whole other thing. But the bottom line was they're still vitally important, but they're also a huge source of confusion for people.
People find the entire watch and warning system confusing, I think, from talking to people about it. And I've talked to meteorologists who say we really have to revise that whole thing from scratch, that it's not working the way it's supposed to. And that's a problem that goes back, well, it goes back to the early history of tornado studies, where people were asking what possible use a warning would have if you can't specifically say where a tornado is going to touch down. And we're still nowhere at predicting specific tornadoes in specific locations. Yeah. We can get the general watches right, but predicting which supercell is going to produce the tornado is still mysterious. Somebody might solve it tonight. We might, you know, wake up tomorrow and National Severe Storms Laboratory might say, oh, yeah, we've got it now. But I know I've talked to meteorologists who think we may never get it.
Well, it was interesting to listen to you on the air with Diane Rehm.
Yes.
You talk because you couldn't have had a better partner that day, and that's Harold Brooks.
Yeah, no, he's great. Yeah.
Brian, you had a question for Luke?
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
But, you know, I thought that was an interesting conversation, and you two were a good compliment on that show, and I enjoyed listening to it. So go ahead.
Yeah, I'll say that was a great conversation, although we were doing it on Skype, and the Skype connection kept on getting lost, just like was happening with me tonight. So, you know, technology never quite works the way you think it will.
Exactly. Your chance.
No, I'm afraid I'll.
Oh, go for it. Come on.
Well, are you trying to cause trouble? Lee, your last comment just irritates the crap out of me because it sounds to me like you're saying that because everybody can't be saved from a tornado and we can't predict them, you know, 3 or 4 days in advance, that we ought to just give up. And like, I don't know. It sounds a little fatalistic to me there.
Well, as I say, it's not a question of whether I think we should give up or not. Obviously, we should go on studying. The question is whether it's solvable to the fine grain that people are expecting, whether it's realistic to think that we will ever get to the point of saying, you know, 3 hours from now, a tornado is going to touch down at this location. And because the conditions that form tornadoes have to be detectable in clouds before the tornado forms. So how far can you push the warning and how close can you actually get to that moment of formation? I don't know. But,
well, I'm not sure that you want a 3-hour lead time anyway.
No, why not?
Well, because if you get too much lead time, you may end up with a situation where people come out to see it happen.
Well, that's happening now.
I mean, chaser convergence.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's people who are not too bright, but.
Well, I've heard people say that the biggest danger from chasing tornadoes now is being rear-ended by another tornado chaser.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So.
And if you expand the warning lead time to, let's just say, 2 hours based on the warn on forecast goal, one of the challenges becomes how do you really frame it for people who might be in that hour to 45 minutes to 2 hour window. You know, sure, they've got an hour and a half to wait. Well, you know, we know from Oklahoma City, we know from the pitcher Oklahoma in tornado, there are a couple of tornadoes that the lead time was such that people had the thought, I can get out of the way of this. And in some cases, Gary England was telling them on television, you either need to be underground or out of the way of this or else you will die.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so they would say, well, shoot, I don't have a basement and I've got 30 minutes. Well, let me hop on the interstate and see how far I can get. Well, how'd that work for folks in Southeast Texas ahead of Rita? We lost more people in the evacuation from Rita than Rita actually killed.
Well, that's always the paradox with warnings of anything. Is the warning going to do more harm than the actual event? And I don't know what the answer to that is, you know? If we had more experience at successfully predicting tornadoes, we would know better how valuable it is, how much lead time is realistic, mm-hmm, and or is realistically useful. So I'm certainly not saying we should stop researching. I think the research has to go on. You know, it's possible that it won't get at the solutions. What I'm trying to argue against is the notion that we've got it all solved now, which I think a lot of people kind of complacently believe when they watch the tornado coverage.
Completely.
Oh, really?
I don't think people believe we have it solved.
That's what I get from when I'm talking to people, but.
But I also got from your from the introduction to your book there that's on your webpage that tornadoes don't really occur in the southeastern U.S. They all occur in the Midwest, and that's definitely not true.
No, no, I never said that.
Okay.
No, I certainly would never have said that. No, I know perfectly well tornadoes occur all over the country. There aren't that many in Arizona, but, you know, the rest of the country sees tornadoes, has seen catastrophic tornadoes all through through American history.
Right.
Yeah, I think, and I think the point, and I'll throw Mike Smith's name out because I know he's argued this in his book, Warnings, that the system works pretty well. And I don't know that Mike would go so far as to say that we've got it solved or that the research is finished. But at the same time, I think there's a difference between saying that we don't have it figured out and we have little skill at all in doing this versus the system's pretty good. It could be better and we need to spend the money and do the research and put in the investment to make it better.
Oh, sure.
And it sounds like you're not making either of those arguments directly, if I'm hearing you correctly.
Well, I think that the basic research is the crucial thing, and I would never say we should stop researching tornadoes. It's more that one of the things that I found kind of dismaying when I was researching the book is the sense that people seem to have had, and I'm not talking about scientists, but these people in the Midwest seemed to be taking the attitude that tornadoes were, I don't want to say solved, but managed, that we now had the warnings so that they weren't as much of a danger as they used to be. And there's statistics back it up. I mean, tornado casualties had been dropping drastically for the last several decades, but now we're seeing them spike again. And it's suggesting to me that we're not as far along as we thought we were.
And how much of that we've solved it or it's been well managed is a direct result of a combination of the lack of deaths in the previous years, with a couple of notable exceptions, right. The general quietude of, you know, the absence of big killer tornadoes like we saw in Alabama and in Joplin, plus the idea of, you know, availability heuristic, and that, you know, we're going to bias things that happened more recently. Oh, that tornado outbreak 10 years ago, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what was going on. Tornado casualties have been dropping up until the last couple of years, dramatically dropping off. I think people got the idea that they were not as great a danger as they used to be. And that's just a statistical fluke, really. I mean, it is true there were no F5s for several years at the beginning of the millennium. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't happen. But there's nothing that says that there was any particular reason for that. That just happened to be the chance of things. And so now the Midwest is getting heavily overbuilt. And one of the consequences of that is that there's less and less unoccupied land for tornadoes to cross. Mm-hmm. So more and more, just through the fluke of development, as tornadoes happen, they're more and more going to be happening in occupied areas.
That's Chuck Doswell's bad luck argument, I think, summed up right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Now, Lee, one last question. We've kept you a long time tonight. You're a very accomplished writer, and we'd like to get some advice for you for the aspiring writers in the audience and talk about how you write.
Well, I came at what I'm doing through journalism, and that is really a wonderful way of learning how to write because you get feedback. When you write something and it goes out into your neighborhood and people call you up and argue about it is a really good way of learning what you're doing and whether it's working.
And you have to do it over and over and over again.
Oh, yeah. You just have to keep on doing it. And eventually you'll find out whether you can do it or not. I think I've got enough now after about 30 years to say I can do it okay. But it was a long time before I even felt that. But the main thing is you just have to keep doing it. And you have to keep showing it to people and you have to listen to what they say, and you have to try new things.
Hey, Lee, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way of doing that?
Well, there's contact information on my website. That's leesandlin.com. And, you know, you can, there's email information there, and drop me a line. And, you know, if you've got any questions or anything, and see whether I can answer them.
Okay, good deal. Well, Lee, thanks a lot for taking the time to be on the show this week. We appreciate you being here. And
my pleasure.
Again, the only problem with you, you thoroughly confuse me because you look just like Brian. And
well, yeah, it's a look we're trying to encourage. We want more people.
So here's the big question. I'll ask you this, Lee. Do you think you and Brian look more like Colonel Sanders or Santa Claus?
Well, I get Santa Claus. I'm betting he gets Colonel Sanders.
So if James can't tell you two apart, does that mean that, wait a minute, Colonel Sanders is Santa Claus?
There you go.
That's why all my stockings always smell like chicken.
All right, Lee, thanks a lot for joining us. Hope you have a great week, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, Lee. Bye.
All right, we're going to take a break for Professor Peters and Weather Brains 101. We've got This Week in Weather History. We've got the picks of the week, the email segment, much more as Weather Brains rolls along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
You may recall Superstorm Sandy last October. Sandy created quite a stir in the meteorological community for a number of reasons. One of the primary issues concerning Sandy was the change in storm structure from tropical to non-tropical just as it was heading toward shore, which resulted in a discontinuation of warnings related to tropical systems from the National Hurricane Center. There have been all kinds of discussions regarding this procedural rule, and no matter which side of the issue you support, it appears that the circumstances which resulted in this fluke have been addressed. So play the breaking news music.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
In a release issued April the 4th, 2013, the rules have been changed relative to the definition of tropical systems. Quoting from that release, NOAA's National Weather Service announced today that starting June 1st, the definitions of hurricane and tropical storm watches and warnings will be broadened to allow these watches and warnings to be issued or to remain in effect after a tropical cyclone becomes post-tropical when such a storm poses a significant threat to life and property. In addition, the National Weather Service would ensure a continuity of service by allowing the National Hurricane Center to issue advisories during the post-tropical stage. These changes were motivated by the special challenges posed by Hurricane Sandy, which was forecast to evolve from a hurricane to a post-tropical storm prior to reaching the coast. The release included some additional information, including this. This policy change was first proposed during the NOAA hurricane meeting this past November and has since been the focus of much discussion in the meteorological and emergency management communities in forums such as the American Meteorological Society annual meeting in January and the National Hurricane Conference in March. This change is also supported by preliminary findings from NOAA's service assessment on Sandy, which will be released in May. So there you have it. Sometimes the wheels of government move slow, and sometimes they move a little faster. But that's not all. Next week, we'll take a look at some other changes coming about in hurricane products.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
I just love playing that clip.
Oh, brother. All right, Bill, the floor is yours.
Are you done now?
It's like Brian is having a field day with this.
I am. James is pushing the wrong buttons over there again. All right, here we go. Play. Cue my music there, James.
I don't have any music for you.
All right, here we go.
Hang on. I can give you... How about the Rickroll music?
All right, Edgar Rice is in baseball's Hall of Fame. He's better known as Sam Rice, who was an outfielder for the Washington Senators from 1915 to 1933. He regularly led many offensive categories in the American League. He led the Senators to 3 postseason appearances and a World Series championship in 1924. He's most famous for the catch. In the 1924 World Series, the Senators were leading the game 4-3 in the bottom of the 8th when Rice was shifted from center to left field. Earl Smith drove a ball right to where he was. He made an amazing catch near the fence, but that was just the beginning. He tumbled headlong over the fence. When he came back up, he had the ball in his glove. The umpire called the batter out, but the controversy raged on. Did he hold on to the ball the entire time behind the fence? Of course, we didn't have instant replay back then, and Rice wouldn't answer questions after the incident, saying only that the ump had ruled and that was it. He wouldn't even accept money to answer the question, saying the mystery was more fun than knowing the real result. He wrote a letter to be opened after his death, and when he died, it was read, and the last line said, quote, "At no time did I ever lose possession of the ball." But his baseball career was nearly derailed by personal tragedy. He married a lady named Beulah Stamm in 1908, and they had 2 children over the next 4 years. On April 12, 1912, he was pursuing his dream of being a baseball player. He left his wife, 2 small children at home as he barnstormed with a minor league team in Galesburg, Illinois. His wife left their home in Illinois and traveled to spend time with Sam's parents at their farm in Morocco, Indiana. They spent the day visiting friends, returned to the farm about 6 o'clock. They were at home with Sam's father, Charles, and mother, Louise, when a fast-moving tornado, or cyclone, as they were called in that day, destroyed the house they were in. Beulah and the 2 children, Bernie, 3, and Ethel, 18 months, were killed along with Sam's mother, Louise, and 2 of his sisters. The hired hand was also killed. Devastated by the disaster, Sam's father died from his injury 2 weeks later. And 75 people would die in that deadly day across Indiana and Illinois. And just 2 days later, the Titanic disaster also occurred. That's a tragic story that's a reminder of the season that we're in now, be it baseball season or tornado season, from the pages of This Week in Weather History. Follow my weather history tweets on Twitter. You'll find me at WXHistorian on Twitter.com. And James, can you tell me something that will have only happened 3 times in the history of Birmingham, Alabama, will happen Wednesday night? What's that?
Wednesday night of this week, like April 10th.
That's right.
It's only happened 3 times.
Yes. Opening night in the new baseball stadium.
Yeah. Ooh, that's right. We have a double A.
The Barons will be moving downtown this Wednesday night.
We have a double A franchise here from, they're part of the White Sox organization. They built a new stadium, beautiful stadium in downtown Birmingham. And I think we'll get that in before the storms. But Bill, you've got to go. So before you go, how about giving us a pick of the week if you have one or anything you need to plug here?
Well, I needed to hear the foghorn, so go ahead and do that if you don't mind. And next week we'll have Seth Bonneau, and I don't have my information pulled up. Dr. John Knox will join us on the 22nd. And most excitingly, we're going to have Bill Reed, friend of the podcast, been on a couple times. He's going to be here on June the 19th. He'll actually come. So, James, I'm going to have to ask for a special dispensation for us to do a Thursday night show. I guess the team will have to vote. But we'll have Bill Reed that night after he speaks to the local NWA chapter. And if we can pull that off, we'll have him on for a live Weather Brains from Birmingham.
And what night is that?
That will be on Thursday night, June the 20th.
June the 20th. Yeah, we'll make that work.
All right.
So I think I might be out of town that week. I only take 3 weeks a year like clockwork. Every year I'll take 1 week in June, 1 week in early August, and then I take a week at Christmas. And that's the first week I can take off in June. So we'll figure something. We'll make it happen.
If we can't have him on Weather Brains, he'll still be here for the NWA meeting. And we're going to have a joint meeting, 1 in Montgomery, students at 11, regular members at 1, and then he'll do the meeting in Birmingham at 7 that night. So it's going to be a fun time with Bill Reed. And the real reason he's coming to play golf with Jim Stefkovic. So, that's all he's
All right. Well, Bill, thanks a lot. And we know that you've got to run, so thanks a lot for your work. And we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Good show. Look forward to hearing what you have to say the rest of the night.
All right. So now, and by the way, Brian.
Yo.
Jason Simpson has a bone to pick with you. In your little Weather Brains 101, you called it Superstorm Sandy.
And what's wrong with that?
Jason, and I believe he's on it. He says there is no such thing as a superstorm. He looked in the AMS glossary, and that was a case of a Category 1 hurricane becoming post-tropical, which happens all the time.
Yeah,
but the media dreamed up this term "Superstorm Sandy" for hype reasons or political reasons or whatever. So
what was the one
Frankenstorm?
Yeah, I didn't use Frankenstorm. Oh, what,
or as we called it in my office, the F word.
All right. Wow. Hey, real quickly, we'll just say quickly doing national weather. We have a pretty dynamic storm system coming across the country, and it will affect us in progressive order. Kevin will deal with it Tuesday night and early Wednesday morning. You get it first, Kev. You get to report on what passes through your neck of the woods there. Then we deal with it. Then Nate deals with it. And it looks like a really nice snow for Denver tomorrow. And again, I do believe I had up on the screen share. Actually, I've got my calendar right there because I was looking at the dates, but I had the snow projection coming off the WSIRPM model. And let me tell you what, that is a lot of snow. This thing is spitting out over 2 feet for parts of South Dakota. And it has amounts of 10 to 12 inches all the way from Wyoming to Madison, Wisconsin, and Michigan north of Detroit. So this is a whopper of a late season snowstorm. And then in the cold air sector, you know, we've got this going on here. We've got the risks. This, what I'm showing on the screen now, this is tomorrow. And the enhancement is from pretty close to you, Kevin. I was looking at the day two, and looks like you're slightly in that enhancement there. And then on day three, it just moves on over. Day three is April the 10th, Memphis, Jackson, Shreveport, Indianapolis, places like that. And then it keeps on moving east. So that's the big issue in national weather. And JB is not here. We'll see if we can get him back on the show next week. But now it's that time. It's that time we read from the email inbox my favorite song of the week here.
Letters. We get letters. We get stacks and stacks of letters.
All right. So I might have kvetched a little last week.
You might have what?
Kvetched. It's a Yiddish word. I'm not Jewish. I'm not Yiddish, but I like Yiddish. It's good language. Anyway,
I'm getting in my pocket dictionary. I'll check it out and get back with you on that. Yeah.
I might have kvetched last week that we were not getting enough listener survey responses. And WeatherBrains Nation rose up and answered the call.
Yes, 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 yes.
Dustin from Sparta, Wisconsin. We are reaching out to the Northlands of the country. I heard about the show on This Week in Google. I love that.
Yeah.
So thanks for James for evangelizing on somebody else's podcast.
And yeah, let's say Kevin's the guy that got me on the show, so Kevin gets the attaboy for that one.
So I also heard from Daniel in Florence, Alabama, who heard about us on the Alabama Weather, alabamawx.com blog. We appreciate both of your gentlemen's listening and sending us the notes. I also have a lot of email this week, a lot of good stuff. A couple of links from Michael W. Moss, friend of the show. One got to some traction. Why is it that it smells so good after it rains? So really interesting from the Smithsonian, and then posted some video from Dave Drummond of a tornado that they nabbed last week. Wallace Stuckey sent us an email about the discovery of the Hook Echo. It was this week a number of years ago, so worth taking a look at. Jeff Wilcox, the Iowa WX guy, sent us a note about the April blizzard from 1973. We'll post a link to all this stuff on weatherbrains.com. John sent us a link to a blog post about future tornado warnings. Good stuff. And then we get some other stuff. Todd Foisey, a friend of the show and former guest from the Weather Service up in Maine, sent us a note sort of following up on our conversation about Weather Service websites and saying that they are trying to clean those up, homogenize them, that they're depending on exactly where you are, which office you're talking about, pretty interesting sort of political forces involved in addition to some technical challenges there. But
I think that's wrong. I think that's wrong, by the way. I think that generic type. This is what happened back in the 70s when they created Action News, and everybody did the same formatted news across the country, and there was no innovation. And I think you ought to give them a little bit of leeway to try new things.
What needs to happen
rather than somebody clamping down and say, you all have to do this, is somebody at the national level needs to be watching what everybody does and collecting best practices and then sharing those around the rest of the country.
Yep. So anyway, I don't know that I disagree with that, but he was just emailing to sort of follow up our conversation about that.
Yep.
Ricky Matthews and Cody, and forgive me, Yuri, I think is your last name. Forgive me if I mispronounced that. Both wrote about weather and Facebook. One of them, Ricky emailed to let us know that if you plug in an event on Facebook and it's within the next couple of days and you click on that event, you'll have a link with weather information that will take you over to Weather Underground. So Facebook is automatically pulling in weather information. So if, let's say, your television station, since we have a number of TV weenies in the audience, if your television station is hosting an event of some kind and you're putting it on Facebook, Facebook is going to kindly offer a link to somebody else's weather data as a forecast for your event.
Kevin's head is about to explode.
And dovetailing on that, big news from the weather world. Weather Channel has entered into a partnership with Twitter to basically put their weather information in your Twitter feed, whether you want it there or not. So interesting there. And then Cody from Red Wing, Minnesota, said that the folks at the Twin Cities office, the Weather Service office, had asked for and received and then made reference to in later products storm reports and flooding reports from people via Facebook. And so they were going out on Facebook doing what television stations do all the time, saying, if you're seeing X, Y, or Z, post a picture, tell us where it is, da-da-da. And then they actually made reference to it in one of their text products later on, which I thought was quite interesting. And then a heads up or a tip of the hat to Eastern New Mexico Weather for a link to all of the Sandy hurricane watch warning stuff. We heard about that. I don't say we necessarily heard it first, but that certainly got the conversation going and might have fueled the Weather Brains 101 fire over there from Brian Peterson. Maybe he already knew about it, but just going to post about it anyway. I don't know. Anyway, if you'd like to send us a note, you can do so. We'd appreciate it. Email at weatherbrains.com. You can tweet us at weatherbrains. You can go to our Facebook page and leave a message there. And fill out those listener survey responses. We do appreciate hearing those. And somebody, by the way, posted a meme, Grumpy Cat, with something about me being grumpy because I didn't have any listener survey responses. That was about right. That's spot on. anyway, we appreciate those. Go to weatherbrains.com, click on the gal that looks like she's having way too much fun with the earphones, and let us know what you think. And that is all I've got about that.
Let's talk about this. Go ahead, Kevin. You got an addition. I have a question. You have an addition.
Well, it's not email, but you know, I usually see my tweet correspondence in email, and it came from Mike Cox, who's a friend of the show, but he got put in Twitter jail the other day.
Sorry.
He was live tweeting the Twister movie.
Oh, brother.
Which, by the way, was hilarious. I had to work Friday morning, and our morning show starts at 4:30. And I was up until almost 11 watching that bloody movie and tweeting and retweeting and everything. It was a miracle I could get out of bed Friday morning. And as a result, I was on fire on Friday in not a good way. A lot of fun. I appreciate Mike sort of instigating that because that was fun.
Well, the fact that he got put in jail, I thought was interesting because of the timing of the Weather Channel thing. And when we get the picks of the week, I'll have more to say about that.
Yeah, the Weather Channel, the tweeter, the Weather Channel thing. All right. On the tweeter. So you're saying on the tweeter.
Okay, Grandpa, what's your question?
Yeah, it's the internet's a bunch of tubes where they do the tweeter.
It's just a fad. It'll go away.
Title, so tubes where they do the tweeter.
You're saying that in my Twitter stream, I'm going to get weather forecasts from the Weather Channel, and I can't opt out of these things?
I don't know exactly how that works. They're going to use something called Twitter cards that somehow some backend processing associates weather events that are mentioned in tweets or some sort of, you know, oh, there's a bunch of weather related stuff, and it'll insert these into your Twitter feed. I've actually, supposedly they've been doing this with a couple of other folks, and I've with ESPN, I think. I've never seen one.
And I have not either. No.
Kevin, do you know what?
Don't you have to be on the web client? You guys don't use the web interface, right?
Well, that's true. I do not.
So you don't get ads unless you use the web?
No, I think these cards are, I don't know, but I think these cards are what's going to show up in the web interface. And I was listening to an interview, I can't remember the guy's name. He was one of the original founding financiers or whatever, investors in Twitter. And he was saying something that suggested that really only about 5%, maybe less than 10% of Twitter users are using a client. And we're talking about TweetDeck, which I guess in part is about to go away, or at least the old one, and some of these other things. But it seems as though they've been wanting to drive people to the website interface. And so I guess that trend continues. But I guess that's where you're going to see these cards. My prediction is that you're going to see it probably regionalized, and the Weather Channel is building an advertising infrastructure where, you know, they're going to, I don't know where, there's some reference I saw somewhere, but they're going to build an infrastructure where if it's, you know, Friday evening or Saturday morning and it's going to rain in your area, then they're going to have a deal set up with Universal Pictures to do a little bit more advertising on the movies this weekend under the presumption that people are going to be looking for something to do inside. And so I think that's what they're going to see. And it makes a lot of sense from, you know, from an advertising standpoint and a Weather Channel standpoint. But yeah, they'll pay to insert these cards into your stream, I guess.
And it's interesting because you mentioned trying to force people back to the web client. There was a big kerfuffle 6 months, a year ago, where they changed how the developers who make the apps that like Tweetbot and TweetDeck and some of the other sort of third-party apps, they made it more difficult for those folks to get access to Twitter feeds and to grow their platforms by putting a cap on the number of authorized users that those services could provide back to or could link back to Twitter. And the thought process at the time was they're trying to force people back to the web client so that they could then drive up advertising revenue because they'd have more people looking at the web client and look at what they're doing. It's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that stinks, man.
It's a tough time right now because I did quite a bit of research and with a couple of companies that do development, and I had an idea for a Twitter weather app, and we got pretty far along it as far as discussions and how it would look and what it was going to cost and yada yada yada, and I really wanted to put that thing out there, but ultimately I've decided to hold it because it's so uncertain about the number of API calls that you get to Twitter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, somebody starting now, I mean, if you've been around and you've got a client for a long time, maybe you have a chance, but, you know, who do you call at Twitter to say, hey, I've got a good idea? Well, even if you do, they're not going to let you in because they want control. And then by making a deal with somebody like the Weather Channel, I mean, it's that none of them are in it for what's good for the users anymore. They're all in a position where they're going to have to make money. The Weather Channel wants to make money. They need to start putting more into their digital platforms because the TV side is dead, which, as you see, they're going to try this business again now where they're going to do more long-form programming. That which they tried only a couple of years ago, which didn't work, now they're going to start putting on more science programming in the evenings as opposed to weather because they need people to stay for, you know, beyond a quarter hour or stay a little bit longer. But I think we've crossed a line. I've had for a long time, for a number of years as we've been doing this program, I've had hope for the local broadcasters and the local TV weathermen that we would still be able to pull some of this stuff back from the edge. And I think we've hit the precipice and gone over. And, you know, James has been saying for years and years that the old model's dying, and that's not news. But I do have this really sinking feeling that we've hit the peak and we're on the downhill slide.
Now that we're all depressed, thank you, Kevin. So we're and again, we'll talk more about that later. But yeah, that thing about Twitter, that's kind of disturbing. I mean, you know, I like Google Plus. I really do. That is my social network of choice. But who knows what that's going to turn out to be in 2 years? So it is totally out of our hands.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I actually overlooked on my sheet where I had sketched out emails and stuff. I think a cat just jumped off the stairs. Anyway, it's a big thump out just outside the office over here, and it was either my two-year-old or the cat, one of the two. Anyway,
great.
That's another show title. I'm good for show titles.
Anytime. You are. You're cranking them out.
My web editors, by the way, the folks that take our news and sort of, you know, repackage it for the web, or actually in a lot of cases do a lot of original reporting for WRL.com, they love it when I do weather because I'm apparently a quote machine. that's good. Anyway, we had an email from Ken, who spent some time as an engineer at Google and who now works for, wait for it, Twitter.
He's a tweeter.
Yes, and so he's just sent us a note to say that he enjoyed the show and enjoyed listening, and so I'm sure hopefully he'll send us an email to correct all of the inaccuracies that we've spit out about his employer.
We need to get him on the show. Yeah. He's the guy we need on this show.
Yeah. Tell us what you do and come on the show. That would be fun. You mentioned Google Plus, but see, this is we're going to run into the same problem again as we've already had. Twitter is not a weather platform. Facebook is not a weather platform, and Google Plus is not a weather platform. And technically, none of them really can, or I don't know if they really have a desire to. When you start looking at these things, James and I have had some discussions with, you know, about Google Plus, and I've talked to some Google Plus people. When you think about what they're doing, they build a platform that has to be universal. And so the problem is the minute you go to somebody like Google Plus and say, hey, I want to do this with your platform with regard to weather, well, you open it up to every other special interest group in the, not only in the country, but on the planet, who wants to somehow customize the platform for their use. Now, is weather more universal? Yeah, it certainly is. But the minute something shows up on the sidebar of the Google Plus that suggests, okay, we've got some sort of weather customization here, then you got to deal with the Save the Whales people, and you got to deal with the diabetes people, and you got to deal with every other interest group in the world, and it doesn't scale. It just can't happen. But yep. we squandered the opportunity in the early days, as I've said 100 times, and I won't go down this road again, but the broadcasters didn't innovate. They let things happen, and then they turned responsibility over to these template companies, and that's what we have today. And they're getting lapped. They're getting piece by piece stuff taken out from under them, like these Forecast IO guys. So anyway. None of this is new for me. I know.
That's right. We got to hurry. And by the way, it just dawned on me. You know what's on TV right now? The national championship game, the basketball game. I totally forgot.
What?
Not that anybody else on this show cares, but Michigan is leading Louisville 46-43.
Hey, you need to give a spoiler alert. People may not know the end of that game by the time they listen to this podcast. All right,
I'm not going to say another word about it because we got to do picks of the week. Bill Murray got this. You hear that noise, that means you don't have a pick of the week. Mine, very quickly, Google Reader is going away, and everybody's got all these suggestions, and everybody mentioned Feedly. Yes, that is the sound of Google Reader going away. And, you know, everybody was suggesting Feedly, and I'm thinking, oh, great. You know, another one of these crap apps, and it's just going to look bad. I've actually gotten into it. I think it is a very well done mobile app, and you can get it on the web as well. So Feedly, FEEDLY.com, and they have mobile apps.
I'll put in another plug for Feedly. One of our sports guys jumped on that a couple weeks ago, did a test, and he thought highly of it, and so I jumped on it. I've been using it for a couple of weeks. You know, it's one of those things where you've got until, I think, June or July before Google Reader finally just goes away for good. And I said, I'm going to give this thing a week, and I'm going to go cold turkey, and I'm going to force myself to use this for a week, and now I'm not going to go back. It's really nicely done. I'm not a big fan of these services that purport to look over your stuff and figure out what's going to be important to you.
Yeah, the magazine type format, yeah.
Yeah, but the Today feature in Feedly actually does a tolerable job of that for me, which is surprising and a little bit disturbing.
This is another benchmark moment. This is really important what's happening here. With the death of Google Reader, there's a lot of complaining about this. But what we're seeing now is that there appears to be this shift away from websites and blogs and readers to social media connections. And so what has happened is that Facebook and Twitter, and now to a certain point Google Plus, are changing the dynamic of the web such that what you're doing is relying on your friends and your associates to tell you what the news is, rather than going and finding it from the sources of the direct reporting yourself. It's fascinating to watch. You listen to some of these tech people, and they're saying, a lot of them have said when the Google Reader thing came out, they went, well, you know what, I'm not really using the Reader anymore. I'm using social media. I'm getting everything I need from Twitter. Think about what that is. These are people that are reporting on technology, paying attention to their friends and associates in hopes that they're going to post something that they're supposed to pay attention to. That is a fundamental shift, and it's almost 10 o'clock. So I'll
and it's one, yeah. It's a big deal too, Kevin, because what winds up happening is a lot of times you surround yourself with people who think like you, who have the same interests as you, that have the same political alignments as you, and all of a sudden what you're reading about, your universe of news shrinks, and it shrinks to form basically the U-shaped bubble. And so all of a sudden, all the news, you don't get any differing opinions. You're never challenged about any of the things that you think about. And as a result, you wind up polarizing more one way or the other. And it happens on all sides of the spectrum.
There is a fundamental architecture shift going on here. And I'll tell you what Facebook did last week. They kicked another leg out of the stool, because I guarantee you that the Weather Channel right now is coding something for Android to mimic this Facebook Home thing,
yes,
whereby it's going to take over your phone with Weather Channel information, and any of the apps that you have, in theory, you wouldn't need behind that, which is another way they're going to try and take over.
Twilight on my iPhone.
I'm so depressed. All right, we got to hurry, guys. I almost started to talk, but I'm not going to do that because we have to do a television here shortly. Let's go to Brian Peters and see if Brian has a pick of the week.
The Joplin Service Assessment Report.
That's a good read. That's a very good read. And by the way, Brian, I was hoping you and Lee would get into a hair pulling, a beard pulling match there. I mean, that was going to be good. That was awesome.
Beard pulling.
Kevin, what's your pick?
The Digital Meteorologist blog, one of the latest posts, it deals with this Twitter thing. There's a link to an article that tells you what's happening with Twitter and the cards and the Weather Channel.
Great. And again, all this is on weatherbrains.com. Nate, what about you?
A link to an article in the Houston Chronicle written by Eric Berger. I was quoted in this article down toward the bottom. The headline is Weather Service's Dated Storm Prediction Puts Public at Risk, although that headline doesn't really match. And a lot of times headlines aren't written by the author of the article. So, but it talks about some of the challenges that we face in terms of computing power, satellite investment, radar technology, and the future of humans in forecasting. Good stuff.
Ooh, okay, good deal. And that should do it here as I check the clock on the wall. Here's the situation. If you want to get in touch with us, and we'd love for you to do that, it's email at weatherbrains.com. You can hit us up on the Twitter. You can find our Facebook accounts on weatherbrains.com. You can leave a comment on iTunes if you happen to listen that way, or Stitcher, whatever client you're using. We love those comments as well. You like us, you hate us, suggestions, and don't forget those listener survey forms. Those kind of help us in planning the show out. So we do thank you. We typically record Monday nights at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. Live.bigbrainsmedia.com is the site. And you can also watch the show later via YouTube or the Weather Brains Google Plus account. And boy, the pager is going off. When I start talking real loud, I'm trying to cover up the pager here. But on behalf of the entire Weather Brains crew, I'm James Spann. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and God bless.